For those of you who haven't seen it, Hidden Figures is a powerful movie on many levels. One quote that has continued to stay with me after seeing the movie is this. As the NASA team struggled with the challenge of launching a human into space and then returning the human safely, the team leaders continued to say one thing. The math for this hasn't been invented yet. The math for this hasn't been invented yet. As I experience the world right now and all our challenges, I keep remembering the words, the math for this hasn't been invented yet. The solution to the problems hasn't been invented yet. And I wish for simpler times like the ones we read about this morning when Jesus, as part of the Sermon on the Mount, imparts wisdom for an ancient set of problems, including what to do when someone strikes you on the cheek, sues you for your coat, or demands that you walk an extra mile. If I could time travel, I would say, that's great, Jesus. But I need the math for global warming, universal health care, reproductive ethics, immigration reform, and a fair tax code. I need the math for curing the most recent world pandemic and for fair distribution of resources, clean drinking water, eradicating HIV and AIDS, and treating black people, Muslims, lesbian, gay, and transgender people, people with mental illness, and also white people, and Christians, and straight people, and all people with dignity and respect. And I especially need the math for racism, for the anti-blackness that is rearing its ugly head right now. I need that math, Jesus. I need that wisdom imparted. But instead, I've got this skimpy 111 verses that Jesus strung together in his longest and most famous sermon. Maybe his only speech that can even be called a sermon, the Sermon on the Mount. Jesus standing on not a mountain really, but a hill on a roadside somewhere along the Sea of Galilee about 2,000 years ago. You've heard that it was said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, but I say to you, do not resist an evildoer. But if anyone strikes you on the right cheek, turn the other also. And if anyone wants to sue you and take your coat, give them your cloak as well. And if anyone forces you to go 1 mile, go also a second mile. Theologians throughout the ages have done the math on those verses. Many have interpreted these words from Jesus as a treaty on non-resistance to evil. The 5th century theologian Augustine agreed that the gospel teaches non-resistance and declared that a true Christian must not practice self-defense. St. Augustine and his contingent have thus been responsible through the ages for scores of women being told by their priests and pastors to not resist the violence visited upon them by partners. Scores of men take the belittling and baiting of bullies until they finally explode in outward-directed violence or violence directed on themselves. Churches have been birthed and quickly died because the Christian interpretation of turn the other cheek has so often been interpreted as a rule that Christians may not say no to bullies, may not set boundaries on bad behavior, and may not, despite its being in the Bible also, put on the full armor of God and defend themselves as if in battle. St. Augustine did allow one exception, however. If someone is attacking your neighbor, he said, then the commandment that declares you must love your neighbor requires you to defend your neighbor by any means necessary, even force. Christians have used this piece of his interpretation over the years to justify war, on behalf of one's neighbor and to support the death penalty. Not until 1,500 years later did large numbers of theologians rise up to question the interpretations of traditional theologians like St. Augustine. In Latin America in the 1950s and 1960s, theologians like Gustavo Gutierrez of Peru and Leonardo Boff of Brazil taught liberation theology, an interpretation of Christian theology which emphasizes a concern for the liberation of the oppressed. They taught that God even has a preference for the poor and for the marginalized. Black and women and queer theologians began to offer new interpretations of Scripture. In the U.S., theologian Walter Wink set head spinning with his controversial ideas about homosexuality, nonviolence, and the nature of Jesus. Walter Wink said to everyone, "Hold on a moment. Pay attention. Understand your history. Do you really think," he asked, "do you really think that Jesus, who resisted evil with every fiber of his body, would tell you not to resist it?" Wink gave history lessons on the evolution of Scripture throughout the ages. "Take the King James Bible, for instance," he said. "King James commissioned it as a response to the liberal Geneva Bible. The translators that King James hired to work on his version of the Bible knew what the man who was paying them liked and what he didn't like, what he wanted in the text and what he didn't want in the text. Specifically, King James didn't want any mention in the Bible that he commissioned of what he viewed as traitorous or seditious notes that were present in the Geneva Bible. He did not want anything that sounded like an endorsement for the people to disobey a tyrant." Walter Wink, as he put these theories together, offered Christians what he called a third way of Jesus. "You don't have to run away from evil," he said, "neither do you have to fight it with violence. There is Jesus's way," he said, "the third way." Walter Wink offered his understanding of this portion of the Sermon on the Mount. "In this verse, if someone strikes you on the right cheek, turn the other also." Walter Wink found permission for sacred resistance. This is Walter Wink's take on the verse. First, he says we have to place it in context. It was a time of slavery, and Jesus was usually talking to the common folk, and many of his listeners were slaves. Jesus knew that a master has power over another and did not necessarily treat slaves as equals. Slaves were reprimanded by a slap with the back of the right hand to the right cheek of the slave whenever the master decided that the slave had done wrong. A backhand of the right hand to the right cheek. But to strike a peer, not as a master strikes a slave, but to strike a peer, your equal, you would use your fist and hit directly, which meant that for right-handed people, and this all assumes that the person hitting is right-handed, and it also takes into account ancient ideas of what the left hand and the right hands were used for. They were used for different things. This takes all that into account and says that if a person were to hit someone as an equal, not backhanded as one would hit a slave, that blow would fall on the other cheek, the left cheek. So, Walter Wink says, when Jesus instructed the people to turn the other cheek, he was telling them to resist. This is what Wink said would happen when the other cheek, the left cheek, was offered. First, the person doing the hitting was forced to consider the person that he was hitting as an equal. Second, the person hitting was given a momentary space to consider that they were abusing power over another, over the person that they were striking. And it gave them a moment to consider changing their behavior. According to Wink, then, turning the other cheek after it was struck by a backhand was not about lying down. It was about rising up. And that makes more sense. Now, this directive to turn the left cheek meshes with everything else that we have been told by Jesus to do to enter the realm of God's heaven on earth. Show love for your neighbors, Jesus said, even when they abuse you, but not by refusing to defend yourself, not by refusing to resist, but by pointing out the unjust nature of their actions and giving them the chance to change their minds, to act differently, to become different people, to act more justly and more lovingly. I hope you were able to follow all that, because the rest of this sermon hinges on that. I'm bringing it up this morning at a time when our news feeds are full of reports about protests throughout the United States. Protests that have arisen after yet another senseless killing of an unarmed black person. I've considered this week whether we, as people of faith, should enter the protest, and if we should, how we should, and what does this moment require from us as people of faith. And so I've thought a lot about sacred resistance and how resistance differs from protest. Simply put, I believe protest is when we object to injustice, but resistance is when we go to work to bring that injustice to an end. And let me put an even finer point on that. For people of faith, protest is like singing to the choir. But sacred resistance is singing to the ones that the church has cast out, and the ones whose spirits have been crushed by the laws of the church, and the ones who don't even know what our Bible is. Protests are about boots on the ground. Resistance is about uprising. In its original meaning, resurrection. Rising from the dead as something new, rising from brokenness to wholeness, rising from hate to love. Resistance is rising up over and over, even when others make it their lives' work to knock you down. Now, that's where my sermon on sacred resistance ends. But here's one other thing that troubled me this week. One of you asked me to preach about where is God in what's happening now. We often talk about where is God in our times of grief and loss, in times of floods and fires, but where is God, this person wanted to know, in oppression? When the boots and the knees of the oppressors are literally upon our throats, where is God then? And I wrestled with it, and I could not figure it out until this morning. And even I didn't figure it out this morning. Others figured it out for me. Let me tell you why you heard me reading the lyrics of I Know Where I've Been this morning instead of hearing Deanna sing it, or instead of watching a video of Queen Latifah. First, the technology piece. Once we got to the point where we decided to show you the video, we downloaded it, got it queued up, tried to see if it would work for you this morning, and found out that as soon as the code was input, Facebook blocked the video because of copyright rules. And I want to let you know, we weren't trying to do something illegal. We have a CVLI license that allows us to show videos as part of our worship services, but I didn't know it didn't cover that. So, with actually no time left before the service began, we realized that we weren't going to be able to show you the video, and that's why I read the words. But let me tell you what happened in the hours before that. Early this morning, while I was still wrestling with an incomplete sermon and having no idea where God is in all of this, I got a text from Daniel. Daniel was passing along to me a concern that he had received from Deanna, who was going to sing "I Know Where I've Been" this morning. I can't speak for her, and I can't share as eloquently what she shared with me when I followed up with her, but Deanna's concerns were many. Should she sing a black person's song? Should she sing the lyrics "as black as my skin"? Should she change them? What had artistic integrity? What had human integrity? How would people take it? What do people need? All these things going through her mind. And so, after talking with Deanna and hearing her concerns, I decided, here's what I must do. I must call black people. And so I did. I reached out to black men and women and said, here's the deal. Here's the song. It's from the musical Hairspray, and it's a scene in which a black woman sings about her memories of the struggle for equality. Can we sing it? And each one of these people said, yes, she can sing it, because I know her heart, and I know our church, and I know what our mission is and what we're trying to do, and I will understand when I hear that song. Ultimately, though, Deanna wasn't sure. She wasn't completely settled in her spirit, so we decided to show the video, and you know what happened then. At 11:01, we still didn't know how we were going to share the song with you. At 11:01, I still wasn't sure where God is in oppression and where God is in resistance. But now, 30 minutes later, I'm starting to feel pretty confident. God is where God always is. In us, in our humanness, in our messiness, in our complexity, in our struggle. God is with us in a time like this, a time for which we do not have the math and we do not have the solutions. God is with us when we have the humility to ask, who am I to sing this song? Parker Palmer wrote in his book, Let Your Life Speak, these words about the word humility. Listen to this. I love the fact, he says, that the word humus, the decayed vegetable matter that feeds the roots of plants, comes from the same root that gives rise to the word humility. How does humility, Palmer asks, manifest itself in leadership and in life? This way, he says, a humble person is more concerned about what is right than about being right. about acting on good ideas than having the ideas, about embracing new truth than defending outdated positions, about building the team more than exalting the self, about recognizing contributions than being recognized for making them. Being humble, he says, does not mean being weak, being reticent, being self-effacing. It means recognizing principle and putting it ahead of the self. It means standing firmly for principle, even in the face of opposition. Humble people can negotiate intensely. They can drive hard bargains. They can express themselves firmly and clearly in intense situations. But they do not get caught up in arrogance, bravado, manipulation, or win-lose power plays. Humble people, Palmer says, also realize clearly that they do not stand alone, but rather on the shoulders of those who have gone before, and that they move upward only with the help of others. As Alcoholics Anonymous and other recovery programs are quick to point out, he says, the foundation of dealing with some of our most difficult life challenges is the wisdom and humility to accept the fact that there are some things we simply cannot do without help beyond ourselves. Where is God in our sacred resistance? God is with us in our humility. Where is God in our sacred existence? God is in our struggle. God is in our confusion. God is with us when we make the sometimes heartbreaking decision to break laws. This quote comes to us from the theologian Sister Anne Montgomery. It's one of my favorite. Civil disobedience is traditionally, she says, the breaking of a civil law to obey a higher law, sometimes with the hope of changing the unjust civil law. But we should speak of such actions as divine obedience rather than civil disobedience. The term disobedience is not appropriate because any law that does not protect and enhance human life is no real law. God is with us when we make the choice to obey things higher than ourselves. Where is God in all this? God is in our very struggle. Jacob Needleman wrote a book called The Wisdom of Love, and he says that we join each other's struggle by sharing our stories with one another. And it is in recognizing our own struggles in others that we learn to love one another. We can be aware of another's struggle for inner freedom, he says, for openness to what is greater within ourselves and from which we are all cut off by our illusions and our absorption in our own fears and desires. But that tends to turn us inwards, and we get focused on the fears and desires. When we open up and are honest about our struggles with other people, and we find that many of us are struggling together, that is when God enters the resistance. And God is in the grace that we give others and ourselves. Here's part of the reason I was having such a hard time finishing this sermon this week. It's because I can't quite figure out what is required from me, a white person, at this time. One of the stories I heard last week was about a member of our church who was moved to tears when she entered her workplace and other groups of people, and no one asked her, a black woman, how she was doing, or how the events of the last few weeks especially have impacted her as a black woman, that no one reached out to say, I see you, I know who you are, I'm with you, or I'm trying to be. It broke her heart and moved her to tears. On the same day that I heard that story, I read an article by a black man who said, I don't want one more love text from white friends who are writing them in the hopes of making themselves feel better. How am I supposed to enter the space between those two extremes? It came down to this, what it always comes down to in our Christian journey: grace. God's grace for me when I mess up over and over again. God's grace for me when I fall short, when I sin. God's grace for me above all else, in my humanness, in my mistakes, in my trying. And our grace for each other in our humanness, in our mistakes, and our trying, and even our grace for ourselves in our humanness, in our mistakes, in our trying. That's where God is. I'm going to draw this to a close by sharing one more person's story. Reynolds Price was an American poet and novelist. He spent the final 20 years of his life lecturing and writing from a wheelchair because of a rare spinal cancer that almost killed him at its outset. His reflections about that experience are written in his book called A Whole New Life. In that book, he evokes the healing vision of Jesus that he believes saved his life. While Price survived both the cancer and its cure, and that was sometimes questionable, he was not able to avoid death altogether. Here is what he said. When you undergo huge traumas in middle life, everybody is in league with us to deny that the old life is ended. Everybody, he said, is trying to patch us up and get us back to who we were, when in fact, what we need to be told is, you're dead. Who are you going to rise up and be tomorrow? Friends, the ways that we have been are broken. Who are we going to be now? It's time for an uprising, for a resurrection. Not a mended way, but a new way. We need the new math, the new solutions, the math that hasn't been invented yet. We need to rise up in sacred resistance, turn the other cheek, speak truth to power, and we need to do it imperfectly. And we need to do it imperfectly over and over and over again until our efforts become a solution. With God's help, God who is with us every moment of the struggle, with God's help, we will get there. Here's what becomes clear to me. Here at Uprising, or wherever you are, We are a mess. A beautiful mosaic of white, black, brown, with pieces missing, pieces in the wrong places. We are a mess, a blessed mess. We've come to the time in our service when we give our tithes and our offerings to God's work in our church. And so here's what I want to say to you this morning. If our mess is helpful to